the baby boomers collectively, 75 million baby boomers, have a net worth of 73 trillion dollars. $73 trillion. And what did they accumulate this all for? Well, when they retired, they expected that they'll be traveling, playing golf, traveling, going out to restaurants.
It's true that many of the experts appearing on this channel so far this year did not predict the markets would be up so strongly as they are so far this year. Today's guest is one of the few who argued for more optimism. What did he see? And what have the bears been missing? To find out, we're fortunate to speak with economist and investment strategist Ed Yardeni, Dr. Ed, president of the excellent research firm Yardeni Research. Ed, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's a real pleasure, Ed. Been looking forward to having you on the program for a good while. I got a number of questions for you based upon a lot of you and your firm's recent publications. Very quickly, though, just to kick things off, I'd like to ask you the very general question I like to ask all my guests when they first come on the program. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, I think it's actually looking better than it did last summer. Last summer, there was widespread concern about what was going on in Europe. Europe looked as though it could very well go into a very severe recession during the winter. And it turned out that Europe did go into recession, but it's a relatively mild one. There was also expectations that once China eliminated its lockdowns last December, that there would be a lot of economic growth led by China, and that's turned out to be disappointing. The most pleasant surprise, I think, to the consensus has been that the U.S. economy has yet to fall into this much feared recession. It's been the most widely anticipated recession of all times, and maybe as a result, it's not going to happen because everybody's sort of making adjustments that reduce the likelihood of a economy-wide recession. But my point is, we really have been in a recession since early last year. It's just been what I call a rolling recession, hitting different industries at different times.
All right, a rolling recession. So is there potential here then that we just sort of hand the baton to different parts of the industries, but the whole economy as a whole doesn't really drop?
I think that describes what actually has been happening. I believe I coined the term rolling recession back in the mid-1980s. We had a plunge in oil prices after they soared in the 70s. And the Texas and Oklahoma and other areas where money had been spent on oil and gas drilling and building a lot of commercial properties for the oil giants, that all kind of came to a crashing end very quickly as the price of oil took a plunge. And this time around, I think we're seeing also a rolling recession, like the mid-80s, which did not turn into an economy-wide recession. And this time around, we have had a recession in the housing industry, but let's be very specific here. We've had a recession in the single-family housing industry. Multifamily has been actually very strong. And when we look at construction more broadly, we've had some really strong numbers coming out of non-residential construction and out of public construction. So we know there's a lot of onshoring going on, factories coming back to the U.S. So there's a lot of building of factories. And we're also seeing just really the early starts of an infrastructure spending program. I live on the East Coast, and the I-95 was disrupted by a collapse in the north lanes. And we're going to have to be
in Philadelphia, right?
What's that?
That was in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, it was in Philadelphia. So there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be fixed in this country. We've had a consumer recession, but it's been in goods. People had gone on a buying binge for goods coming out of the pandemic. Then they had more than they wanted. Retailers ordered too much and they got stuck with a lot of inventory. So they had to discount it, which is what happens in a typical goods recession. But meanwhile, the consumer swung around and started spending like mad on services, the cruise lines, for example. Those stocks have been on fire. So I think when you look at it kind of sector by sector, you can see some areas of weakness offset by areas of strength. And all in all, it's still adding up to an economy that in GDP terms is growing by 1-2%.
All right. Great answer. I want to dig into it more deeply with you just to put a little bookmark to get back to. GDP has been growing GDI has been contracting, and we've had a couple of experts on this program recently, like David Rosenberg, who's been sort of looking at that contrast. Would love to get your opinion on it. But before we do that, I do want to underscore what you talked about, because you've written some very recent observations of this that I think is really important. You've kind of coined a term called MAMA, making America manufacture again.
Yep.
You've got some great stats that you recently put out here. You're talking about the trillions of incentives that are flowing, you know, into the manufacturing sector.
Correct.
So much so that you say it's getting hard to find shovel-ready mega sites for new plants. So almost the demand to spend the money is overwhelming the physical, you know, opportunities on the ground. You said that capital spending in real GDP hit a record high of $3 trillion in Q1 of this year, right? And that's a big deal. So we're looking at a lot of recessionary data, but there is still a lot of fiscal spending coming into this.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important part of the story, because in previous recessions, the Federal Reserve, which caused many of the previous recessions by raising interest rates, would then reverse course and lower interest rates. And it would take a while before fiscal stimulus would come into play. And by the time fiscal authorities lowered taxes or increased spending, we were already in the recovery phase. This time around, for the past couple of years, we've had legislation being passed that spends hundreds of billions of dollars on infrastructure and provides incentives for technology companies to bring production back here, particularly for semiconductors. So that has to be taken into consideration as another source of stimulus offsetting whatever weakness we're seeing in some areas of the economy.
I'm curious, do you think the Federal Reserve is happy to see that amount of fiscal spending coming into the picture right now? Or is it some ways, is that sort of at odds with what they're trying to do the economy with quantitative tightening and higher rates?
Well, it's a bit baffling because they have this notion at the Fed that they do monetary policy, they don't do fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is up to the president and to Congress, and they don't comment on it. But they certainly have to take it into consideration when they conduct their monetary policy. And right now, they've been tapping, slamming on the brakes, however you want to look at it. But they've been really trying to slow the economy down. And meanwhile, the fiscal authorities have been slamming on the accelerator. Generally speaking, that's not a great way to drive a car. you wind up probably in the ditch. But I don't know that car analogy particularly works in this situation. I think it just, as I said, all adds up to a soft landing for the economy.
All right, soft landing for the economy. Now the Fed is out there trying to tame inflation right now. Yep. And obviously the fiscal side of the story is not helping, I would imagine, do that. So what is your inflation outlook here?
Well, I think inflation is moderating. It certainly looks as though it peaked last summer. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the reasons that a lot of economists really haven't understood what's going on with the economy is they simply forgot the very simple thing, and that is the pandemic was a big deal. It was something quite different than we've ever been exposed to. It's certainly nothing that was ever included in any model of the economy. And so you had to really kind of scramble to really understand that the pandemic was a huge deal. It was a huge shock to all of our lives. And there've been a lot of aftershocks. And one of the shocks was inflation. And a lot of that was related to the fact that the government provided what I call helicopter money. Of course, the originator of that expression was Milton Friedman, and that was picked up by Ben Bernanke. And the idea is if you drop money from helicopters, people will pick it up and they'll spend it. And that's basically what we did during the pandemic. There were three rounds of checks that were dropped, deposited in people's bank accounts. And the Fed was at that point very easing in its stance on monetary policy. And the result was lots of spending on goods, big jam up at the ports of LA, a lot of trouble getting trucks to deliver the merchandise. And that created a huge inflation in the goods side And then with a lag, we started to see it also in rents. And rents also was affected by the pandemic. A lot of landlords couldn't raise rents. Maybe some couldn't even collect rents. And so once the moratoriums on landlords were lifted, they scrambled to make up for what they had lost. And so I think a lot of the inflation has been pandemic related. And as we're moving in time away from that shock, I think we're likely to see that inflation continues to moderate. I also think we're going to have a productivity boom to deal with the fact that we have a labor shortage. That being the case, I think there are a lot of forces in play to bring inflation back down.
Okay. Let's trundle over to jobs for a moment. Sure. So given what I understand from your outlook, particularly the sort of rolling recession where I don't think you get the sense that we're going to have an economic trough that's coincident with a bunch of layoffs like we saw in 2008 right. or even in the tech sector in 2001. To folks that are worried about the jobs data worsening because we've been near right. record low unemployment for so long, seems like you think maybe we're going to sort of stick there for a lot longer, stick near the lows?
Well, I'm a big believer in staying close to the data and trying to determine what the data is saying and where it's leading. And in the payroll employment numbers, we've had several months of better than expected payroll numbers, a few hundred thousand per month. The labor force has been expanding as people see more opportunities for getting jobs. There's a real shortage of labor. We know that job openings are basically running 1.8 job openings for every unemployed person, and they're still remaining at that kind of level. Construction employment's at an all-time record high. That doesn't happen in recessions. In recessions, housing activity takes a dive, and so does construction. But as we just discussed, there's a lot of reasons why construction is remaining strong in multifamily starts and non-residential construction and in infrastructure spending by the government. Another kind of pet theory of mine, and it's related to my age. I'm 73. I'm a baby boomer, and I'm increasingly unique because I have no plans to retire. All mm-hmm. my friends are retiring, and that leaves me with a lot of free time. And a lot of them have accumulated a pretty good amount of wealth between pension payments and the Social Security, 401k, and just what they've accumulated in their house and in their own investment portfolios. And the baby boomers collectively, 75 million baby boomers, have a net worth of 73 trillion dollars. $73 trillion. And what did they accumulate this all for? Well, when they retired, they expected that they'll be traveling, playing golf, traveling, going out to restaurants. And when you look at the restaurants, you see they're full with a lot of people with gray hair. When you look at the airports, you see there's a lot of people with gray hair that are traveling. This all leads to a tremendous demand for waiters and waitresses and airline staff. That's where we've seen a lot of the job demand. As we said, the fiscal stimulus is very big, and we need a lot of construction workers for infrastructure and onshoring.
All right. As long as the baby boomers are feeling flush, right? And yeah. And right now we have last year I think was probably a pretty nerve-wracking year for many of them, right? Seeing mm-hmm. the net worth, at least of their financial assets, go down 20%+.
Right.
But this year obviously is off to a much better start. Why don't we talk about that for just a minute? So like I said in my introduction, that you were a lot more optimistic about where the markets could go earlier this year. They've now had a really big run. They've been largely powered higher by the mega cap eight. And I've seen some recent writings of yours saying, the downside to these sort of melt ups is they do tend to be followed by meltdowns. Are you as sanguine about the prospects for the markets now as you were at the beginning of the year, or have things maybe gotten a little bit too far ahead of themselves given this run up?
Well, it was really at the end of October that I looked back and I said, I think we might have made a low in the S&P 500 on October 12th. The NASDAQ didn't really bottom until late last year. And it's actually up a lot more than the S&P 500. My call was based on just the tremendous amount of pessimism that I saw out there. To be quite honest, I actually thought we bottomed on June 16th, when we got down to 3,666. I've had something about these Da Vinci numbers in my career. And so I said, maybe that was the low. We did have a nice rally through August 16th last year. But then I anticipated that Fed Chair Powell might be a spoiler, and he sure was. And started talking about, you know, interest rates having to go still a lot higher. And then the market took a dive through October 12th. And I think it was a very successful retest of the June low. It was about 2% below the June low, but I figured that technically speaking, we retested the low. Pessimism was as thick as it was back in March 2009. And surely things aren't anywhere near as bad as they were during the great financial crisis. And then I've been in the rolling recession camp. It seems like most other economists and strategists were convinced we were going to go into recession. And their simple observation was, we've had a tremendous increase in interest rates perpetrated by the Fed, and that's got to lead to recession. And some of them said, when we run out of excess savings built up during the pandemic, we'll surely fall into recession. And I've been saying, you know, we're in a recession. It's just a rolling one. And meanwhile, there's a lot of reasons to believe that it's not going to turn into an economy-wide recession. And that was really the heart of my fundamental analysis for believing that we weren't going to have a severe earnings recession and that earnings would recover.
All right. So for folks that are pointing to, you know, a lot of these classic recession indicators like inverted yield curves, leading economic indicator, data sets that are down only at levels you see during recessions. I guess you would say, yeah, because we're in a recession. It's just sort of evenly, or not evenly distributed, but it's I guess rolling probably is the best term. Yeah. And therefore we're just not going to see the typical kind of widespread pain that we expect to see during a normal recession. So like if the NBER came out and said, hey, a recession started in November of last year and ended in September of this year, I don't think you'd be that surprised.
Well, I would be surprised in the sense that my definition of a recession that I share with the NBER is really based on the index of coincident economic indicators. Recession indicators, of course, has been the index of leading economic indicators. It's been down since December of 2021. And so it's really been predicting that a recession is due by now. But meanwhile, the index of coincident economic indicators, I think through May, is at an all-time record high. Usually in a recession, you see a peak in the index of coincident economic indicators, which is monthly data. And then you see it going down, and then at some point it troughs. And the recession peaks and troughs always have in the past coincided with that index of coincident economic indicators. So, you know, I don't know that we really need the dating committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research to come up with that observation. You could all do this. Anyone could do this at home. Mm-hmm. But they like to get together and chat about these things, and they pretend that their insights are based on a lot more than just one index, but I kind of question that. Leading economic indicators, one of them, of course, is the inverted yield curve. They've been pointing out to a traditional severe recession. I've often said that, you know, any data that doesn't support my outlook is bad data. It's going to be revised. I'm not really making that argument about data. The data that's out there now. All I'm saying is that while most economists have said, you know, the leading economic indicators have never been wrong, they've gotten eight of the past recessions absolutely right, the same thing for the yield curve. I said, well, it doesn't mean that they aren't due to be wrong. I mean, they could be wrong once in a long track record of being right, especially when you consider the things that are different this time, like the demographics that I alluded to with regards to the consumer having a tremendous amount of retirement wealth, like the fiscal stimulus, which is very unusual to occur before a recession and to stimulate an economy in a way that makes a recession less likely.
All right. And we've had a lot of conversation on this channel of what we refer to as the pig through the python, right? Which was all that stimulus that was pumped into the economy, monetary and fiscal. And, you know, once it starts coming out, it was, you know, starts getting used up, then people were predicting, okay, we're going to have that really nasty recession. We've talked about how the fact that, okay, yeah, the monetary stimulus really, those nozzles got turned off. The fiscal stimulus, though, is still kind of roaring. So we do have that making its way into the real economy with all these construction projects we talked about. You're kind of adding almost a third source of stimulus now, which is retiring boomers, right? And yeah, that's, what do you say, $73 trillion? I mean, that's a big pile. $73 trillion.
Yeah, that's the data compiled by the Federal Reserve as part of their U.S. financial accounts data. It was a few years ago they started to create a distribution account framework where they see who's got the dough, and they look at baby boomers, silent generation, Gen X, millennium, and you know, it's one of the reasons that we have income inequality in America is because older people tend to make more money than younger people. They also tend to have more money stashed away, saved away, invested, and we have a huge generation here of baby boomers that have accumulated a lot of wealth over the years. And you could say, well, it's only the top 1% that have accumulated that wealth. That's really not true. A lot of wealth has been accumulated in pensions. Social Security is a source of wealth. Then of course, the housing equity is big for a lot of people. And you know, when people retire, they no longer have kids. The kids are out of the house. They don't have that expense. They got more time to travel, to go out, to eat. They certainly don't want to cook dinner and just have the two of them sitting at home. So the demographics is a very, very important factor. So is the fiscal stimulus. So is the onshoring. And so is the underlying resilience of the economy and financial system. The banking system just had a little bit of a stress test, and it actually passed it pretty well.
Okay. I think that's a really important element to consider. And I just being honest, I don't think we've talked about it enough on this channel in the past, which is the spending coming from the boomer generation really as sort of a third stool here of stimulus. Because you mentioned it, I'm curious, what's your outlook for the housing market, right? It definitely seems to have peaked. So we seem to be undergoing some sort of correction. I think the question is how much we've seen. I mean, I could put together a long laundry list, I think, of depressive factors on the housing market. But the big one, obviously, is the fact that mortgage rates have more than doubled, right? Do you expect to see perhaps a bigger correction in the housing market than we see in other parts of the financial markets themselves, or the economy, or are you optimistic about its future too?
Well, I'm relatively optimistic. I don't see it being a huge booming sector anytime soon with mortgage rates so high, but there have been a lot of unusual developments in the housing market. Again, there's a lot of aftershocks related to the pandemic. When the pandemic hit, we were all locked down. And then as soon as the lockdowns were starting to get lifted, people ran out, especially urban folks, and started to look for houses in suburban and rural areas. And a lot of that supply was taken very quickly in reaction to that kind of behavior. And then some of these urban folks started moving back to cities because they missed the urban environment. But a lot of people who have houses decided that even if they could trade down because the kids are gone, they really didn't want to do that because they basically locked themselves in to a very low mortgage rate. Right. And so we've had a real shortage of housing for houses for sale. And that's actually benefited the home builders who've been able to produce some houses and get buyers for them without having to really slash their prices. So what's been unusual about this housing recession is we really haven't seen a big drop in home prices because the supply is so slim relative to the demand. And so I think the housing market's actually in a pretty good balance at this, where we are now, and you can see that by where the prices are. I think that as people get used to the fact that we're back to a more normal interest rate environment, where mortgage rates, maybe 7% is excessive, maybe we'll get back down to 5 to 6%. I think that'll be enough to bring back some buyers, maybe requiring a little bit more of a haircut off the price being asked by the sellers. But all in all, I think that markets, despite this huge increase in mortgage rates, has weathered the storm reasonably well. I mean, housing starts are down for single families and existing home sales are down for single families. But I think you'd see a lot more existing single family home sales if there was supply. Just can't find it.
Right. So I totally get what you say. We on the other side of that is we have housing being the most unaffordable it's ever been in U.S. history right now, right? So, you know, the question becomes, you know, there are always going to be, even if sellers are on strike, right? We're not moving, we've got our low mortgages, right? There's always going to be some organic amount of sales being done for deaths and divorces and all that type of stuff, right? So that does set price discovery, but that can take a long time. And if we don't have an earnings recession like you're talking about, you know, maybe the economy continues to recover enough where it becomes a little less unaffordable to folks. Or to your point, if mortgage rates come down, that obviously helps things a bit.
Yeah.
So I guess just what I'm not hearing you say is, hey, I think housing looks, you know, like it's got a pretty grim future ahead of it here. I think you're saying it's going to muddle through probably at worst.
I think that's where we might want to think about the demographic angle again, too. The baby boomers that are retiring, I think there's 46 million people that are seniors, 65 and older, that are not in the labor force. And presumably many of them are simply retired. It's in relatively good health. But they may very well be willing to provide the down payment for a house for their kids. I mean, people sort of make adjustments and there may be a generational shift. I mean, the baby boomers, main question right now is how much to leave the kids versus how much to splurge on themselves. And some of them might just kind of split the difference and said, you know, we love the kids, but they were noisy. We didn't like their friends. So we don't have to leave them everything. Let's have a good time. Let's travel. Let's go to restaurants. Let's check in with the doctor just to make sure that this little ailment isn't anything serious. They're spending money, and they could also afford, I think, some of them to provide the down payment and maybe a little bit of monthly support to support a mortgage. So I wouldn't underestimate that demographic phenomenon as a source of surprising resilience, even in the housing market.
Yeah, I wasn't going to ask this question, Ed, but you're really making me want to ask it, so I'm going to do it. We have the dynamic here of a large generational cohort that has amassed a lot of wealth, right?
Right.
The problem is that wealth isn't evenly distributed, right?
Right.
So what's the stat? It's something like 10% of households own 90% of the financial wealth, something like that. I mean, it's quite lopsided like that, right? So the policies of the Federal Reserve have been very rewarding to people who have had assets over the past 12 years or so, right? It's created this big wealth gap in the country. And we now have, you know, the 75 million baby boomers that you mentioned, that 73 trillion isn't evenly distributed, right? A lot of it is in a relatively few households, right? And they're going to power the spending that you're talking about.
Yeah. I'm going to do, I've got the data, I've been looking at the charts, I just need to write up the story. But when you actually look at the distribution of assets held by the baby boomers, there's pension benefits, which isn't just rich people. There's houses, which isn't just rich people. So it's a little bit more nuanced than just saying that, you know, there's a minority that has all the wealth, and how many kids do they possibly have, and how much can they actually leave the kids? I think we're looking at a much much more wealth, more, I wouldn't say evenly distributed, but enough to, you know, create the question for retiring baby boomers about how much to spend on themselves and how much to leave to the kids.
Okay, so you're saying it's not quite as lopsided as I was making it sound.
No, and it does, and, you know, where in the wealth distribution arguments, people always seem to ignore Social Security. But Social Security, when you take the present discounted value of that, it's wealth. When you look at some of these municipal workers that get to retire at the age of 50 and get retirement benefits for the rest of their lives, they're basically millionaires. I hope I don't get any bad feedback on all this. But the idea is you need $1 million to generate that kind of income over the rest of your life. So the whole income distribution argument is a very complex one. I've done a lot of work on it. I wrote a book called In Praise of Profits, and basically looking at the wealth statistics and the traditional argument that we have a tremendous amount of wealth inequality. It's somewhat exaggerated. It's not wrong. It's definitely true. We can definitely see it and sense it. But there's a lot of $73 trillion is a tremendous amount of wealth, and it's not all just a few families.
Okay, I appreciate the nuance, and this is I'm enjoying this discussion. I'm going to finish the question just to get it out there, and you can shoot it down. But I'm glad you brought up pensions too, because I've mentioned that actually a lot on this channel. That if you've got a pension, it is like having millions of dollars in the bank. And of course, we know that pensions are largely an artifact of the boomer generation now. They're not as easy to get. So kind of where I was going with all this is if we have a you know, relative minority of the boomer households that have a lot of financial wealth and they're potentially helping their kids out, you know, with that. And then we have the other cohorts that have pensions or whatnot, right? The younger generations are sort of looking at that and saying, hey, unless I've got rich boomer parents, there seems to be a real disadvantage here. And it seems that policy has really been favoring one part of the populace and not the other. I'm just curious if you have thoughts about that.
Well, I think policy has been disadvantaging younger folks. While the baby boomers may have $73 trillion to pass on some portion of that as a legacy, let's not forget that the baby boomers, and we know that all of our political leaders in Washington are baby boomers, what have they been doing on the deficit side? The federal deficit, depends on how you measure it, it's somewhere between $20-30 trillion. It's huge. And this is sort of the bequest we're leaving to the younger generation. People often ask me, why hasn't the deficit already created all sorts of problems? Why hasn't all this debt already created some sort of problems? And I tell them, in a sense, it's the baby boom generation has basically taken money from their kids, or they passed on debt to their kids. Mm-hmm. Future generations, I think, are going to be more constrained in their ability for the government to issue debt in order to finance social welfare programs, infrastructure, and so on. So I don't disagree with you. I think that's been the case. I think we've disadvantaged younger people with these student loans. When I went to college, I don't remember college being expensive. I know it was like just a couple of $1,000, and maybe on a current basis, that's a lot more, but it wasn't a lot of money back then. There was financial aid for those who couldn't afford that. But now what we're doing is we've seen these colleges dramatically increasing tuition to, you know, $250,000, $500,000 for an education. And then these poor students have to borrow all this money in order to do this. And the colleges are building stadiums, and they're building more buildings and hiring more administrators. So I think that's not fair. That, you know, I got a really good deal on an education, and I've got five kids, and the first three, I don't recall feeling like it was a particular burden to pay for their education. the last two was a killer. So it's like I'm all too aware of just how ridiculously expensive college education is, and that's a major source of income inequality between generations, as is the deficit. And so I think the baby boomers do have some responsibility and blame here in the inequality. And as I said, the politicians are all baby boomers.
Ed, boy, I'd love to spend another hour kind of peeling this back with you, because I agree with everything you're saying, and there's so many other questions related to this I'd like to ask you. And I just want to make the point here too that the college education element is a big factor in the explosion of costs. There has happened after the government really pushed out the other lenders and got involved in financing of college loan debt, right? So it's sort of policy related.
Absolutely.
But maybe we can have you back on to really explore this topic in a lot more depth. Let me just sort of end this part of the conversation by asking you if on this sense of sort of we've pulled a bunch of prosperity from the future to enjoy in the baby boomer generation, and we're leaving the younger generations kind of with a bill, right? Simple way to look at it. If we made you emperor tomorrow, Ed, is there any particular reform that you would be challenging to try to address this?
Well, I think, we need more competition in a lot of industries. We need more competition in the healthcare industry. We need more competition in the education industries. Some of these industries have become oligopolies, and trying to figure out, I've got my own little company, and health insurance just keeps going up double digits every single year. And, my employees share some of that, but it's my responsibility to carry most of it. And, I've tried reading these plans, understanding, and then when I actually need them and go to see what I'm getting charged, it's like, I haven't a clue what they're charging or why they're charging. And, the whole deductibles, it's a real, it's really not a good system whatsoever. And so I think we need to figure out ways to bring more competition there. And as we just discussed, there's way too much cost embedded in the colleges, which then they pass on to the students, and that just burdens them dramatically.
Okay. We've talked a lot on this channel in the past, Ed, about sort of the corporatocracy, sort of these corporate cartels that have emerged in most sectors now. So just for the record, I'd vote for you as emperor. Let's put it that way.
Look, I think it's corporatism. It's it's when the government and big business get together and basically conspire. The businesses write the regulations, and the government says, "Yeah, that's okay, as long as I can be a lobbyist once I am no longer a politician." I mean, there's a lot of corruption in our political system, but you know what? That's kind of human nature. I mean, there's no country that doesn't have corruption, but I think we need to blow the whistle on these things and recognize when it's affecting the prosperity and the standard of living. I mean, you can see prosperity going up in countries with corruption. The problem is that the prosperity could be a lot greater and a lot more equally distributed if there was better control of corruption, better inspector generals and prosecutors focusing on some of the excesses that go on with corporatism.
I couldn't agree more. Well, Ed, talking about emperorship, but there's a presidential election next year. If you want to, get yourself on a ticket, I'll vote for you.
All right. That's okay. I'll pass.
I want to be very respectful of your time. It's been a great discussion. Before I wrap it up and ask where folks can go to learn more about you and your work, if we could just end sort of on your market outlook in general. So as you look ahead for the rest of this year, what do you see? I'm not looking for price targets, but do you see a continuation of the rise that we've seen this year? And in particular, as most people who watch this channel are just regular investors who are trying to figure out where the market's going in position, are there any sort of allocation strategies that you think will perform well given what's ahead?
Well, I think first and foremost, my view, I share a view with Warren Buffett, and with Jeremy Siegel that stocks are really meant for long-term investors, trying to pick the top in a correction or even in a bear market is great if you can do it. But then you also have to remember to pick the bottom, because if you miss the bottom, you just wind up spinning your wheels and missing out on dividends for a period of time and paying commissions and so on and so forth. I think you really have to view sell-offs as opportunities to buy more stock, not to suddenly bail out in a panic fashion. I don't think we're going to have the Great Depression again. I don't think we're even going to have the Great Financial Crisis again. We just had a bear market that didn't really last that long. The S&P was down 25%, but it's already made quite a bit of that back. So I think stocks should be in portfolios, especially for younger people. You may not have the money, but you allocate some money to stocks. And keep in mind that the biggest return from stocks can actually be dividends, just compounding dividends. I think you have to have the same attitude towards bonds. You know, I think current bond yields, the current yields look pretty attractive to me, especially since I think inflation is on its way to coming down still further. But I do have a target for the S&P 500. I think right now it's around 4,300. I think it's going to go to 4,600 before the end of the year, or by the end of the week, the way things are going.
At this rate, right? Yeah.
It's gone a little faster than I anticipated. And I've been almost pleading with the market, please don't go up so fast. Because melt-ups do sometimes lead to meltdowns. But you know, the melt-ups have been led by the mega cap 8 stocks. And these are top quality companies with profits, with cash flow, with great technologies. So I think we had a great opportunity back in January to buy the mega cap 8. I don't think we're going to get that opportunity again. Next year, I think the market could be get to 5,200 by the end of next year. So I remain fundamentally bullish on stocks. And I think the market's broadening out. It narrowed there with the banking crisis. People bailed out of the banks and ran into the mega cap 8. I think the financials make a comeback. I think the energy companies make a comeback. And I really like industrials. I think we've recently seen the industrials, materials, and materials have made a comeback because people are starting to realize there's a tremendous amount of money that's going into infrastructure and into onshoring.
Yeah, and you gave us some of the numbers earlier here. All right, so thank you. That's it's very specific and very, very actionable, which is exactly what we're looking for here. All right. Well, look, this has been fantastic. And I did find one other question I wanted to ask you. I'm kind of shoehorning it in here at the end. It doesn't fit kind of the flow we've been in, but I have been a longtime follower of your research and your charts. You do a very good job of tracking the activity by the central banks. And I'm just curious, I feel like I can't leave you without asking you this question. We've just seen an explosion in the balance sheet of central bank balance sheets, right, over the past decade plus, right? Do you expect that to moderate in any material way as the economy, global economy recovers here and the pandemic fades into history? Or is this really just an inexorable march towards purchasing power destruction?
Well, I certainly hope that the central bankers get off this obsession with things like quantitative easing, namely increasing the size of their balance sheet. In an emergency situation, it's fine for 6 months or so, but don't keep going on and on and on. QE1, the first round of quantitative easing after the great financial crisis, made sense. Liquidity that was provided when the pandemic first hit with the lockdowns, that made sense. The liquidity provided to contain the banking crisis made sense, but that's all has to do with the central bank's primary function should be financial stability. Forget about this dual mandate of inflation and unemployment. It should first and foremost be financial stability. And so they have the tools for financial stability, but they can also abuse those tools and create financial instability. So I am concerned that they've got too much power and that there's too many macroeconomists like myself running these institutions that just base what they do on their theoretical models and don't seem to have any relationship with real human beings and our needs, wants, and desires. But I hope that the experience of the past decade or so convinces central bankers that you don't want to go there again. You don't want to go to zero interest rates. You don't want to go to quantitative easing. You want to stay as normal as possible. And I think we're kind of moving in that direction, certainly in the United States. And then we didn't even talk about this. So I think we're in the early stages of the roaring 2020s, where technological innovations like artificial intelligence and other technologies are all going to combine to increase the productivity of workers, increasing prosperity, and being quite bullish for the market.
Oh, gosh, you're opening a door here I'd love to walk into right now, but we're near the end of the conversation. So next time you come back on the program, Ed, we'll focus on the roaring 2020s. Sure. Really interesting thought bomb you just dropped there. All right. Well, look, having to leave it there, sadly, for folks that have really enjoyed this discussion, maybe this is the first time they've been exposed to you and your work, Ed, where can they go to follow you in your work there at Yardeni Research?
Yeah, about a year ago, we created a research product for individual investors. It's www.yardeni, so my last name, Yardeni, followed by Quick Takes. So yardenikwicktakes.com. And it's exactly what it says it is. It's Quick Takes. It's basically, you know, what economic indicators came out today and how do they affect the markets? Why do they affect the markets this way? And what might be the next market mover?
All right. I know your firm's also got a Twitter account, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And LinkedIn. Great.
All right. Yeah. When we edit this, I'll put up the links to Yardeni Quick Takes and to your Twitter account on the screen there so folks know where to go.
Perfect.
Also put links and your LinkedIn in the description of the video below, folks, as well.
Sounds great.
And Ed, this was a great conversation. You gave a lot of great actionable investing ideas there for folks. Folks, if you have a good financial advisor who is considering all the macro issues that Ed and I talked about here, helping build a personalized portfolio plan for you and then executing that plan for you, fantastic. You should stick with them. Guys like that are rare. If you don't have one, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, consider talking with one of the financial advisors endorsed by Wealthion. To do that, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. Only takes a couple of seconds. These consultations are totally free. They don't cost you anything. And there's no commitment to work with these advisors. They're just offering these consultations and their counsel as a free public service to help as many people as possible position themselves to protect themselves against what might be coming in the markets or to profit from what may be coming. And Ed gave us a lot of, you know, potential reasons we may be able to have some good opportunities to profit ahead here. And if you enjoyed having Ed on this program, would like to see him come back on the channel, please cast a vote in favor of that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Ed, it was real pleasure to have you here on the show today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Pleasure. All the best.
All right, everyone else, thanks so much for watching.